So this evening, unsurprisingly, John and I would like to offer some further reflections on this quality of equanimity. It's a profoundly large landscape, and it's actually not possible for us to do justice to it in 45 minutes. But as John really stressed earlier on today, the centrality of equanimity in the Buddhist teaching. Using it interchangeably with nirvana, it's sometimes said to be the crown of all of the other Brahma viharas, that it brings all of the other Brahma viharas together. So we will do our best to offer some meaningful reflections. There's a wonderful just a little quote from the Zen tradition that says, when you sit, just sit. When you walk, just walk. Above all, don't wobble. I don't know if wobble, you know what that means. Don't swing back and forth. Don't wobble. Lenin, this speaks somewhat to equanimity about learning to be somewhat steadfast in our intentions, in our values, in our aspirations, in our practice. It is important to understand that equanimity does not leave the other Brahma viharas behind. It is infused with metta, with compassion, with joyfulness. This is actually what rescues equanimity from being indifference. You can be deeply equanimous and you will feel many things. You will feel many things. But there are other things that you won't be pushed by: your reactivity, your moods, your opinions, your places of holding. I think of equanimity, it's not a state, it's not some kind of cold stare of attention. It's not a state. I think of equanimity as really being a very deep embodiment or fruition of understanding. And what are some of those understandings that bring us to equanimity? And one of the understandings is around the three characteristics, around impermanence, around dukkha, around non-self. These are part of that, very much a part of that deep understanding. Because when we no longer place pleasure and pain as being implicit in objects, craving and aversion do begin to fall away. We don't look out at the world and say, oh, this experience or this person or this object holds some implicit power to make me happy or to make me unhappy. That's where craving and aversion begins. We understand that this is not so. We understand, yes, there is the pleasant and the unpleasant in life. This is not what knocks us off balance. What knocks us off balance is both our reactivity, our wanting and our not wanting, but also the ways in which we externalize these powers to make us happy or unhappy. When we understand that there is no independent self-existence in anything at all, including ourselves. All of these constructs that we have and identify with about who we are, who other people are. When we reify a self in anything at all, there is that sense that there is delusion. There's confusion. And of course, identification with the I am is a root of so much reactivity, so much craving, so much aversion, so much fear, so much anxiety. We understand deeply the emptiness of independent self-existence. Where do we cultivate equanimity? Well, we cultivate equanimity in all of the places where we do find ourselves being knocked off balance. These are our classroom. You know, this truly is our classroom. And many of those places, of course, will be quite unique to each of us. But there are also some other universal themes where equanimity becomes deeply important in actually restoring and renewing and sustaining a sense of balance. John spoke about one of those domains earlier today, the winds, what are sometimes called the worldly winds, you know, praise and blame, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and loss of fame, judgment. You know, we live with those worldly winds. They're part of our lives as being human beings. And yet so much, we form a sense of self around them. You know, I'm really wonderful. You know, I'm really terrible. I'm really successful. I'm really a failure. We identify with the contents of experience. And when that happens, equanimity disappears. And I think one of the very big lessons of equanimity is about non-identification with the contents of our experience, not defining our sense of self by the contents of our experience. Another domain of equanimity, which is truly powerful, is in the domain of what some of you will be familiar with, the Vedana, or the feeling tone of experience, the way that all sensory impressions have an imprint on consciousness preverbally as being pleasant or unpleasant or neither. There's nothing ethically wrong with that, that it's just what's happening. And yet the place where we often get really knocked off balance is when those feeling tones of pleasant and unpleasant seem to be so ironed in, so welded to underlying patterns of reactivity, of craving, of aversion, of confusion. And certainly one of the jobs of mindfulness is to sever that link between feeling tone and those patterns of reactivity. But this is also where we cultivate equanimity. Can we be equally near the pleasant and the unpleasant and that which is neither? I think another domain of our experience where equanimity is so important is in the domain of our relationships with each other. The people we love, the people we struggle with. Isn't this a place where it's so hard to, so challenging to stay balanced? How we can, you know, so quickly move into, you know, sense of injury or not having enough or, you know, not getting what we need. How challenging it is to see people that we love suffer. How challenging it is to show up for that without being overwhelmed. I think I'll pause there for a moment and pass over to John.
Okay, again, I want to pick up on some of the things Christina has said so far. Like Christina, I don't think that equanimity, as I don't think nirvana, is a state. And this is very important because if it's not a state, it's something which is more like a skill that we have and can develop. So the response to life is a skillful response that we're looking for and developing and cultivating on this path. And absolutely essential to that skillful response to life is a deep understanding of it. You know, Christina has already said this, I just want to say a few things on the back of this, is a deep understanding. This is considered to be one of the supports of equanimity, is deep understanding, along with insight into things. But insight here isn't an intellectual insight, it's an embodied insight, a living of, not a holding in mind of. Understanding is the more cognitive side of this. Understanding, for example, and this is the main domain of equanimity, and it's encapsulated in the phrase that I offered you this afternoon, all things rise and fall. All things rise and fall. This is the domain, you know, all of those worldly winds are risings and fallings, which will possibly happen to us in our own lifetime. They're not unknown to us, let's put it that way. You know, all of us have probably had at least some of those worldly winds. It might not be the fame and fortune bit, but it might be, you know, the praise and blame, certainly. The pleasure and the pain. These are rising and falling. They're evanescence. They're like, you know, the Buddha describes this as like froth on the waves. You know, they're bubbles. They come and they burst and they disappear again. They come and they burst and they disappear. This is life. You know, this is this constant rising and falling. And our self is no different from this. Our self is a constant arising and falling. It's a process. It's not a thing. And that's all we mean. The understanding and the insight is that living of the process rather than the clinging to what we think we are. The living of the process. Yeah. When we cling to ideas of ourselves, we are inevitably clinging to something that's usually past. It's gone. You know, as I indicated this afternoon, you know, I just mentioned Montaigne. Every time he said he tried to write a sketch of himself, he'd already changed by the time he'd done the sketch of himself. It was like, you know, trying to pin yourself down is an incredibly slippery business because everything is changing. So everything is changing and things change at different rates. You know, human beings are rapid changing phenomena. The pyramids might change a little bit slower, but they're still changing. You know? And so that domain, that ground of equanimity is the confronting of the changing world, yeah, and the living of that changing world. Because as Christina rightly says, every sensory contact, including the contacts that we have with mental phenomena, comes with a taste. It comes with a taste, that taste which she referred to as Vedana. You know? That Vedana is simply the taste of our experience. And how does our experience taste? Well, it tastes pleasant and unpleasant. Yeah. And so everything that comes to us is pleasant and unpleasant. And of course, this activates and sediments reactive patterns towards pleasant and unpleasant. Yet we're not going to evade it. We're not going to escape it. You know, the only, in a sense, way of dealing with, the only skillful response to this changing world is to come into this position of taking that big view. Remember I said this morning, or this afternoon when I introduced this, it was taking that bigger view. Yeah, that not just this phenomena is changing that affects me directly, but everything is changing. Yeah. To hold that bigger view is to place yourself even that changing self into a more spacious, you know, arena, rather than a constricted arena of trying to cling to the pleasant, to cling to the praise and reject the blame, you know, to cling to the pleasure and to reject the painful. You know. This is what is required to create the skillful response. There are other things required. There's actually listed 7 factors that support equanimity, and these are just 2 of them. The living insight. And what I mean by that is it's not simply enough to know to live with equanimity. One has to know and live with change as an intrinsic part of what life is. Yeah. The poet Rilke in his elegies once wrote, you know, we live in this world forever taking leave. I think it's a beautiful expression. We're always, in a sense, saying goodbye to something. You know, that's part of the pathos of the human condition, that, you know, we recognize that. We're conscious of this. We're conscious of this leave taking that constantly goes on. And we ourselves are evaporating almost, yeah, like water left out in the hot sun. We evaporate, yeah. The change is occurring. So the insight is the ability to live that. It's not just to understand it, it's to live it. So this is what I call the embodied insight, yeah. The embodied insight is so, so different from an intellectual understanding, which in a sense always distances it from us. Now, one other factor I just want to mention before passing it back to Christina here that's so important. It's a factor that often gets translated, unfortunately, as faith, and I don't like this translation. It's a term in Pali which is sadha, which means a deep sense of trust. And this is the trust in your own ability to live skillfully. Yeah. Often we don't have that trust in ourselves. When we are lacking mindfulness and when we're forgetful, we often forget those deep resources within us that we can marshal and call on to live in these ways. And that requires us to trust in the process of what we're doing, in, you know, in developing the insights, in developing the understanding, you know, in developing, for example, a greater sense of well-being in this world, a greater sense of flourishing, which is again another support of this process that we call, or this skillful responsiveness that I would call equanimity. So equanimity isn't just a state, it's a process which marshals all sorts of conditions for it to take place. It rests upon, obviously, the other Brahma-Viharas, and Christina started off saying, of course, they're not separate. Of course, they infuse that. It infuses our way of looking and responding to the world, those 3 other Brahma-Viharas, the metta, the karuna, the mudita. It infuses our way, but also it calls upon other skillful attitudes that we possess, you know, which are not listed in the Brahma-Viharas, because this is, as you know, I was saying this afternoon in response to one of the questions, this is one map. There are other maps that say, well, these are what actually holds this equanimity and makes it so dynamic. So it isn't just an empty category, yeah. It's something that we can truly, truly live. And I'll, you know, after I passed it back to Christina, I'll come back to these after she's spoken. Christina.
I want to spend a little bit more time with this domain of embodied understanding, because this is really what allows equanimity to be. I mean, John has spoken about the landscape of impermanence. And it's so interesting, you know, it's a landscape that none of us intellectually argue with, and yet we can live in a way as if it's not so. You know, doing so much to try and protect ourselves from change, from loss. At times, there's something of fearless in equanimity, of looking life in the eye, of knowing this rising and falling. It's me too. You know, none of us has an exemption. It's me too. And what does it look like to live in the light of that understanding? Now, what would change in our lives to live in the light of that understanding that there is nothing that we can see, hear, touch, love, hate, that is not going to change? I think part of that landscape of embodied understanding includes, you know, something we have spoken quite a bit about on this retreat of dukkha. You know, that not only the vulnerabilities we have as human beings to be able to embrace those, but the dukkha of instability, you know, it can be so startling to us, can't it, to realize that we're actually not very much in control. We're not actually much in control. If we were in control, we're not really doing a very good job, are we? We're actually not really in control of very much at all. That all of us standing on these sands of changing conditions, you know, if we seek control as a response rather than understanding, then our lives become very fearful. And very fearful, very defensive, trying to make things stand still for us. It's an impossible task. Understanding non-self, as I've mentioned, the emptiness of an independent self-existence. This is not bad news, by the way. This is really liberating. This is really liberating. You know, we can hold so tightly to a sense of who I am, you know, who I am. And who I am, of course, is shaped by whatever we identify with in any moment. It's why we have so many changing selves, because the focus of our identification just keeps shifting, doesn't it? But it's almost like a habit pattern. Well, it is a habit pattern. The habit pattern of self-building, as if somehow this is providing the pilot in the cockpit who's going to be in control, you know, who's protected from dukkha, who's protected from change. And yet it's so painful, the contractedness of that. So painful is the contractedness of identification. And there is something, and so little equanimity within it. You know, do I like this self? Do I not like this self? You know, what does the self need to do to, you know, fix itself? There's so little equanimity in it. And there's something so deeply liberating about allowing ourselves to be fluid. Allowing ourselves to be, you know, not a finished manuscript, but an unfolding process where we can flourish, where we can deepen, where we can be responsive. And there's somehow something so strange, isn't there? That the perversity of almost, you know, the addiction to that habit of self-building and learning to release that, somehow is bringing a kind of cooling into our lives, where we don't have to be so central. We don't have to be in control. And it's truly a gift. And I think this is one of the most important, you know, one of the sort of many important teachings of the Buddha, but this teaching of non-self doesn't mean no self. You know, you'll still get up in the morning and know where you live and know what job to go to and, you know your address and know which cars you're. Don't worry about it. You're not going to be forgotten or disappear. What will disappear is the clinging, the identification, the contractedness and the pain and the reactivity. And what will emerge in the light of that understanding is a much, much deeper sense of balance. of steadiness, of poise. John, I'll turn back to you.
I came across a saying many, many years ago now, but I wished I'd coined it myself. It's one of these sayings, which follows on in a sense from what Christine has just been saying. And the saying was very simple. It goes like this. It says, relax, nothing is under control. Yeah, absolutely nothing is under control. Yet we act in the illusion of that we have control. This does not mean we don't have choice. But the majority of the factors in our lives, we don't have any real control. In fact, we're embedded and we're enmeshed in systems that enact and influence us and move us and shift us in ways that we can never fully comprehend. Yeah. So if we seek to control the world, we really are on a loser. You know, we really are on a loser seeking to control the world. It's, you know, it's like trying to, you know, it's like this legend of King Canute we have in England of telling the waves to go back. You know, that's the futility of trying to hold back what is unfolding as a world and we cannot control it. Yeah. Yet our self, this reified self that Christina has spoke about, thinks that it can control these things and that we can control even ourselves. And as we know, we can't even control that a lot of the time. You know, of course, I'm not going to eat that chocolate biscuit, and you find yourself eating it. Yeah, as soon as it slipped from our minds. So control is an illusion. It's a chimera. It's something which it's a fantasy that we can really cling to. And the self clings to it, I think, enormously. And that's part of its reification. It's part of its sense of identity. Now, Christine has already spoken about that, so I'm not going to go on about that. But I just want to mention one of the other facets of the things that support equanimity. And it's the realization of a sense of freedom. Yeah, it's a realization of a sense of freedom. Notice freedom is different from control. Yeah? Freedom is the freedom to make choices. We have spoken a lot, either in, you know, the introductions to the sittings or in these talks in the evening about, you know, in a way, the reactive patterns which are constantly triggered. And there's so many ways of understanding this psychologically in Buddhism, as well as outside of Buddhism, the way that we are propelled into reactive patterns. But the one thing that the Buddha is absolutely clear about, where there is habit and where there are reactive patterns, there cannot coexist freedom. Yeah. Freedom does not dwell and coexist with reaction. Yeah. It's only when we begin to, in a sense, stand back from our patterns, begin to view them, begin to see them and disentangle ourselves from them, that there becomes the chance of choice. Yeah. It's really interesting. It's that gap that Christina spoke about in relation to Viktor Frankl, you know, and what he spoke about, you know, as a survivor. That when we have that moment of choice, we have that moment of freedom. Yeah. And that moment of freedom, of course, is deeply supportive of equanimity because it means to choose not to react. Yeah, I don't know how powerful that sounds, but it's an incredibly powerful thing to actually make the choice not to react, to go down the same old tracks as if they're laid down like rail tracks that we just run down every time certain things happen. Yeah. This is, in a sense, the freedom, and it might sound almost counterintuitive to go off the rails. in this way, to actually not follow those patterns, some of which are societally conditioned, not just conditioned by our own histories. Some of them are societally conditioned, but it often means going counter to them. And freedom is an enormous support once we recognize that we can take freedom into our hands. And of course, the key to that freedom, and there was a question this afternoon about the Satipatthana Sutta, and I was going to say something, but you know, Christina and Antonio had already said something about it. But when we look at the word sati, which is the word in Satipatthana, which is the word that's translated as mindfulness, in these early texts, there is no word that is used more frequently as a technical term than the word sati. This is how important it is. And sati is the key to reclaiming our freedom, to reclaiming the freedom of choice, which gives us the power to embrace equanimity as opposed to simple reactiveness. Christina.
Sati we translate as mindfulness, although it's something of a limited translation. I want to speak a little bit about equanimity in the domain of human relationships, because these are the places in our lives, aren't they, that are the most tender, where we feel the most vulnerable. You know, our relationships with people we love, our relationships with people we struggle with, you know, we're so vulnerable to being injured. And equanimity is not like some sort of shell that we put around us. You know, that vulnerability will remain. Perhaps we won't give so much authority to the judgments of others. Perhaps there'll be a certain acceptance of others as they are. But it is a huge, huge area. You know, people that we struggle with so often, you know, that the fear and the ill will keeps so many stories going, you know, and we have all kinds of narratives about how they need to be different and how they need to change and, you know, what they need to do to improve themselves. And our narratives really don't make much difference at all, except to tie ourselves up in knots. It doesn't mean that we condone the unacceptable. Never. But it's recognizing that our ill will and our fear and our stories really are taking us to places very far from where we want to be. We care for people. We love people. And there's hardly anything so terrible in this life as to seeing people that we love suffer. And the knowing that we cannot always take that away from them. And equanimity actually is what helps us not to fall into patterns of agitation and fear and anxiety, and enable us actually to be present with people we care about when they are suffering, knowing that we cannot fix everything, knowing that there are conditions again that we are not in control of. There's something terrible about seeing people we care for make bad choices, you know, and descend into, you know, places of darkness and despair. I had a student, and some of you have heard me share this story before, whose son was a drug addict, and he, despite all his best efforts, he could do nothing. And he, except to still love him. And he talked about seeing a picture in an art gallery of a woman standing on the banks of a river, and she had no arms as her baby was being swept away on the currents. And he said it was such a powerful moment of understanding for him, to understand that he did not have the power to change the course of his son's mind. But he did not have the power to change the course of his son's mind, that he could not undo his son's patterns for him. He could not take away his son's his son's fears and addictions. And this is a powerful realization for us, that other people can care for us deeply, can't they? And they'll be there for us in our lives, but they don't hold the power to change the course of our minds. No matter how much they love us, that is actually in our hands. And somehow that, I think that very deep acceptance of not holding that power, I think it doesn't send us into the darkness of despair. In a way, it frees us to be present in the face of suffering without agitation, without busyness, without the busyness of all of our strategies. Sometimes we can just be present and take care of what is needed to be taken care of. We should not think that, we have to wait for the huge dramas and, the huge crises in our lives to cultivate equanimity. We have, I would say, a million opportunities every day. The sound we don't like, the food that we wish we had more of, the sight that we flinch away from, the emotion that we kind of dismiss or turn away from, the little moments of clinging, the little moments of craving, the little moments of aversion. This is actually where we practice equanimity. It's a little bit like Antonia said this afternoon, start with what is manageable. Start with what is possible. And we are absolutely not short of those opportunities. To not wobble, to be upright, to be grounded, to be open, to be responsive, from a place of not being for or against, not hating, not pushing away, not clinging, not craving. We have the freedom to do that. And I really feel that, these small moments in our lives, these are our trainings for the bigger moments. These are our trainings for the bigger moments when things truly can fall apart. I turn over to you, John, for these last few minutes.
Well, what I think Christine has just been talked about, I think, is summed up very nicely in one aspect which I haven't mentioned so far, but obviously Christine has now covered it. But it's beautifully summed up in the sense that we are the owners of our own actions. No matter what is said, done for us, we, in a sense, are still the inheritors of what we've set in motion, unless we come to some realization about that that can truly, truly change us. But that can only happen within our own processes. We can't do it for another. Yet, equanimity isn't so like some carapace. It's like some shell that we place around us, as Christina said, that doesn't admit of certain things which are really fundamentally important to human relationships. And equanimity in the text is often seen as being the foundation for caring, for truly caring for others. That I cannot affect you ultimately doesn't stop me caring for you. And that caring relationship, we might be expressed in innumerable ways. And so equanimity, rather than being the protection against caring, which is actually indifference, is actually opening us up to a far more caring relationship. I care for you even though I can't change you. In that destructive relationship with drugs that Christina's talking about, I should imagine the parent does not cease to care for their son in that, and perhaps deeply so, but it becomes perhaps a caring without strings in the end, And that's truly part of the equanimity. I will only love you if I can change you and you do what I want you to do. You know, that's not real love. That's not real care. You know, caring, in a sense, is caring even when you are deeply, deeply unhappy, sometimes self-destructive. This is opening us up, that foundation of equanimity, to that genuine sense of caring. It also says it opens us up to three other facets, and I won't cover these in detail because we don't have time, but it opens us up to a sense of presence, the presence of the other, and the presence of really being present for the other, which, as you can see, is deeply related and allied to the sense of caring. How can I really care if I'm not really present for you? Yeah. Yeah, this is coming. That spaciousness of mind is also a sense of really being present, of being much more cleared rather than just reacting to this is unpleasant, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, this is pleasant, and the ways that we just are thrown around like a pinball in a machine. Yeah. When we are truly present, we hold that bigger picture. We hold you within a wider landscape, yeah, of causes and conditions that I might have no inkling of whatsoever. Yeah. And that's to be really present for somebody and to hold them in their presence as they manifest, not as I would like them to be. Yeah. It's a really difficult thing to do, and I'm sure you realize that. That comes through embodied insight as well. And finally, there's two other things. There's the flexibility of response. Yeah. That the response isn't just one thing. A response, if you like, is to the situation. It's not manufactured before. It comes through the flexibility of a mind, again, which isn't swayed by the opinion or the dogma that it happens to be stuck in, and this is the way I deal with somebody in X situation. Yeah? To be truly flexible means to respond to that situation in a far more spontaneous way by the sense of that openness again. And the final thing that's really mentioned is a sense of remembering. Yeah? Often translated as diligence, I don't like this. It's a sense of real remembrance as opposed to forgetfulness. Yeah, and what's there also within our sense of equanimity is the remembrance of being, of ourselves and others, the animate, the inanimate, everything is held within that equanimous thing. Everything, in a sense, is noticed, but without reactivity. Yeah. That's holding in remembrance and not in forgetfulness. In forgetfulness, we simply react. Yeah. We do not respond. We do not act. And in that, of course, there is no freedom. And this path is, as I think I said yesterday, according to the Buddha, is a path that has that taste. That taste is the freedom to become unbound from the reactive patterns which dominate our lives and those that live around us.